This is Lake Effects on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. A year ago tomorrow, a tropical wave in the Atlantic Ocean coalesced, strengthened, and became Tropical Storm Sandy. It became a hurricane 2 days later. By the time it reached the East Coast, it was a post-tropical cyclone, and its effects were enormous. 117 U.S. deaths, mainly in the Northeast, thousands of homes and businesses destroyed, and billions of dollars in damage. It's been widely redubbed Superstorm Sandy. Climatologists say the storm's strength may well have been exacerbated by warming ocean temperatures brought on by climate change. That's not a surprise to Bill McKibben. He is the founder of the environmental group 350.org, which works to affect climate change policy around the world. But McKibben, who started as a staff writer at The New Yorker, describes himself as an unlikely activist. His new memoir, Oil and Honey, details the major transition in his life as he led one part of the fight against the proposed Keystone XL oil pipeline. Bill McKibben joins us in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
Mitch, it's good to be with you, and good to be with you in the middle of the country, not just on the eastern shores of the country.
And in the part that people often think of as flyover country, but you have made plenty of stops in this part of the world.
I was in Wisconsin last winter I wanted to race the Birkebeiner, and they were kind enough to let me give a big talk up in Hayward at the theater the night before, and it couldn't have been a more beautiful day for the race, and it's nice to be back when the ground is free of snow, but I like it best in the winter.
You describe yourself as an unlikely activist and maybe an unlikely person to be the public face of the Keystone XL pipeline fights. Do you think of yourself then as an unlikely memoirist as well?
Yeah. I mean, most writers, there's a certain amount of memoir or a certain amount of writing about what you're doing. But I mean, what's odd for me is the thought that there is more than writing. I've been a writer my whole life, and I thought that was my contribution to this work. I wrote the first book about climate change. But at a certain point, it became clear that writing another book about this stuff was not going to move the needle. We'd won the argument a very long time ago. We just kept losing the fight. So we're going to need to marshal some resources. It wasn't going to be money. The fossil fuel industry has – well, I'm no theologian, but they appear to have more money than God. So we're going to have to find some other currencies to work in. And the only ones we could think of were the currencies of movements, passion, spirit, creativity. Sometimes you got to spend your body, I guess, and go to jail. So that's the kind of thing that people have been doing now these past few years. And though we have not won by any stretch of the imagination, I think we've begun to put up a decent resistance to the most powerful and most rogue industry on the face of the planet, the fossil fuel industry.
Was it your leadership model that you wanted to put on display, or your passion, or something bigger than that, that you might hope would rub off on people from reading this?
I hope that what they get is the story of what an unusual kind of movement this is. This isn't the 60s anymore. We don't have – there's no great charismatic leader, no Dr. King. There's no central obvious organization, the NAACP. There's a very sprawling, spread out resistance to the fossil fuel industry, much of it rooted in local concerns, but able to come together when the questions are national and global. And in an interesting way, it mimics, it mirrors the kind of world, the kind of energy system we want to build. You know, not a few huge power plants, but a 10 million solar panels on 10 million rooftops all interconnected. That's the kind of movement it is, and it's exciting to see it. And so I wanted to describe a little bit what it looks like. My role in a certain way has been as a kind of pollinator, as it were, flitting from one place to another and helping kind of spread the message and spread those connections. So maybe it was also fitting that half the book is about our great pollinator, the honeybee, and my neighbor in Vermont, Kirk Webster, who's one of the great apiarists in the country, the first chemical-free apiarist, and really figuring out how to cope with some of the traumas that have beset the gentle honeybee in recent times.
He is in this book for more than metaphorical reasons, and bees are there for more than metaphorical reasons. What do you think that this movement can learn from the way, for lack of a better term, the way bees do business?
Well, I think that non-hierarchical hive operation is kind of what I've been describing as how this movement might work. Bees are pretty amazing. There is a queen bee, but her job is mostly laying eggs, you know. The hive gets done what it's going to get done through a kind of almost unspoken cooperation. And some of it's fascinating. I refer in here to a book that a professor at Cornell wrote a couple of years ago, our leading bee entomologist. And he took on the interesting question of how bees, when they swarm, decide where they're going to relocate to. And it's not that they swarm when there's too many in the hive, and so half the hive leaves and the queen goes with them. But they don't. The queen does not go off and find some new place. Queen just stays there on the branch surrounded by most of the bees while a few thousand scout bees go off and scout every possible, you know, hollow log and eave and things they can find. And then they come back and in essence they take a vote on where they're going to go, and then they all go there at once. It's a quite remarkable democratic process in a sense, and I'm afraid it demonstrates a fair amount more reason and comprehension of the need for survival than our democracy in Washington does at the moment, where it's, let me tell you, next to impossible to get these jokers to focus on anything that matters, no matter what it is, but definitely anything that has to do with science or standing up to the fossil fuel industry.
Well, and so what do you make of the kind of the dance that President Obama has done around climate change?
It's to be expected because there's only so much he can get done, even if he wanted to, with the Congress that he's got. I mean, the Republican majority in the House doesn't believe in science, man to a man and woman. They keep saying, no, it's not real, it's not, which is crazy. I mean, Republicans used to be in the forefront of the conservation movement. They are no more, in large part because the party's been purchased by people like the Koch brothers, the fossil fuel barons. So Obama, you know, is limited in that way. That's why it's so important that in the few places where he is a free throw, he take it and sink it, the Keystone Pipeline being the great example. He could, if he wanted to, deny this permit all by himself without having to ask John Boehner's permission. And that's what we've challenged him now to do. And I don't know how it's going to come out.
Do you ever consider writing off a segment of the population? You write about the hate mail you receive, the profanity-laden, vitriolic emails and letters to the editor. And I would imagine most of them are not necessarily from oil company executives. These are just regular people.
No, that's right. So somehow this question, which is just scientific, got caught up in all the ideological mills. I mean, I think it got caught up there because that's where the oil industry wanted it to be, and they paid a lot of money to make sure that there was a lot of disinformation and things. But yeah, I mean, so I don't write people off, but I don't think it's profitable. I don't spend my time trying to convince the last 20% of Americans who are skeptical about this stuff to believe in it. Mother Nature is doing a perfectly good job of that, and at a certain point, everyone, just by looking outside their door, is going to understand the trouble that we're in from climate change. But there are just ideologues who can't, you know, I mean, I think their syllogism goes like this: free markets solve all problems. Free markets are not solving global warming. Therefore, global warming is not a problem. Okay? That's not a very good syllogism, but I can see how it would be emotionally comforting if you'd spent the last 20 years marinating in Rush Limbaugh, you know. For me, the far more important task is to get the 65 or 70% of Americans who know we have a real problem and get some of them actually really active in doing something about it. That's enough to solve this problem. Even 5 or 10% of people truly active would be plenty to win these fights. So that's what we try to do.
This is not preaching to the converted. This is preaching to the complacent, maybe.
Yeah. That's a perfectly good way to put it. And in any rate, preaching to the choir is a useful task anyhow. If you can get the choir singing the same hymn at the same time and singing it loudly, then you have some chance. If the choir has all decided they want to sing random pages of the hymnal at their own pace, then it's unlikely to lure many people into the church.
Might be my daughter's fourth grade choir.
There you go.
Much of the line of reasoning from the petroleum industry today casts the current situation as an engineering problem with engineering solutions. How do you see that differently?
In fact, the CEO of Exxon used precisely that language, engineering solutions. And someone said to him, "What do you mean by engineering solutions?" And he said, "Oh, well, say we need to move our crop production areas. We can do that." Most people know crop production areas by the name farms. And in fact, we can't just move them. It's true that Exxon has melted the tundra for us, but that doesn't mean you can just take Iowa once it's gotten too hot to grow corn there and transplant it to Siberia. There's no soil. I mean, the corn will fall over. So what we need to do is re-engineer the economics of energy. Our basic problem is the fossil fuel industry is the only industry on Earth that gets to pollute for free. Okay? They can pour that carbon into the atmosphere at no cost. That's why sun and wind and things are so slow to take off. It's not that they're technologically impossible. We know they're not. The one country that's done it half seriously, Germany. And there were days this summer when the Germans generated more than half the power they used from solar panels within their borders. Okay? And this is Germany. My sense of Wisconsin is that there are enough people here of German descent that you could probably, you know, ascertain from them that Germany is not actually a very sunny place, you know. But they have political will to do something about this. There are more solar panels in Bavaria than there are in the United States. Think what a country might do that had, oh, I don't know, Florida, Texas, Nevada, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, Georgia, North Carolina to work with. You know, we might actually really get someplace.
You know, one of the things that many in the climate change movement point out is that these larger and more violent storms are becoming the norm. They're coming with increasing regularity and they are essentially kind of a regular part of the landscape now. Do you worry that as they become the norm, people will think of it as just another storm? Was that Irene or was that Sandy?
Right. You know? And there's a sort of deeper thing. I mean, you know, you and I grew up with real winters, and so we recognize when the winters we have don't look anything like that. But if you grew up with what we have now, you might start thinking of it as a new normal. The problem is that though human psyches can kind of adjust in those kind of ways, all our physical systems can't. Corn grows at a certain temperature. When it got as hot as it did in 2012, it was too hot for corn to fertilize. Trillions of kernels of corn across the Midwest went unfertilized. Agronomists tell us that from this point on, each degree increase in global average temperature should cut grain yields about 10%. So the scientists say you're going to raise temperature 3 or 4 degrees. That's 30 or 40% fewer calories on this planet. The federal government spent more money last year recovering from Sandy and from the Midwest drought than the federal government spent on education. That gives you some idea that we're starting to eat the seed corn, you know, and it's going to get a lot worse unless we get a lot smarter fast.
As you think of this work that you do, what makes you happy?
Well, what makes me occasionally optimistic is that the movement is growing fast and it's a diverse and beautiful one all over the world. 350.org, which I helped found, works in every country on the planet except North Korea. I don't know if we're going to win, but I do know something we didn't know 5 years ago, which is that there's going to be a serious fight.
Occasionally optimistic is not exactly the same thing as happy.
I do my best, Mitch.
And you still, I'm guessing, try to avoid bee stings when at all possible.
I wear my beekeeper's veil with religious – I'm not one of these casual guys who's just out there willing to take a few stings. I'm a coward.
Well, Bill McKibben, I'm appreciative that you were not a coward to come into the radio studio and share your time with us.
It was my great pleasure, Mitch. Many thanks.
Bill McKibben is the founder of the environmental organization 350.org and author of Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. He was in Wisconsin this month for a talk at the Oconomowoc Arts Center, sponsored by Books and Company. A short break now, and in just a moment, auto contributor Mark Savage checks in on the 2014 car models from the Corolla to the Corvette. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.